Yesterday, we more or less covered the subject of the killing of Putana. I actually wanted to touch on a couple of other points as far as the anatha which is involved is concerned. A couple of little historical points first. We mentioned yesterday that when Lord Krishna killed Putana, then he purified her of all whatever material contamination was there, and as a result her dead body was very fragrant, extremely fragrant, like aguru, which is very rich and very beautiful fragrance. So it's described that when Putana's body was burnt, such a massive body, the description is that her body was cut into pieces, and because the body was so large and some parts were 12 miles that way and, you know, was covering a vast area, so her body was cut up and burnt in different areas. So there are these fires going on in a 12 mile circumference sort of, that sort of area. So it's described that when her body was burnt, then there was so much smoke that it formed great clouds all over, because it was covering this large area. These fires were going on in different places in a 12-mile area. So all these big clouds formed in different places, and then they started to rain. And when they rained, the water was beautifully fragrant. Very, very sweet and fragrant. Also, another interesting thing about Putana, as we mentioned, she's the sister or perhaps daughter of Bali Maharaj, who is the grandson of Prahlad. So when Lord Nrisimhadev killed Hiranyakashipu, then he gave Prahlad, afterwards he gave Prahlad the benediction that I won't kill any of your descendants. And as a result, as we'll read in a few days, when it came time to kill Dhenukasura, Lord Krishna didn't kill Dhenukasura. Lord Balaram killed Dhenukasura, because Dhenukasura is actually the reincarnate form of one descendant of Bali Maharaj, actually of one of his sons. So Krishna chose not to kill him, but rather let Lord Balaram do it. Whereas on the other hand, we've just seen that Lord Krishna personally killed Putana, even though Putana, in the previous lifetime, she was a apparently direct descendant of Prahlad Maharaj. So, how come? Why this apparent sort of inconsistency there? So, it's explained that because Ratnamala was in a female form, she wasn't exactly considered to be a member of the family of her grandfather or great-grandfather, but rather when she became married, she'd be considered a member of that family. So, therefore, Krishna didn't treat her as a family member of Prahlad Maharaj as such, and he personally killed her. Anyway, just an interesting little bit of technical information there. And another point, we were discussing 2 days ago about the different types of anathas on the different levels and so on, and I said I would type it out and get it photocopied, so we've done that. Actually, there turned out to be more information than I thought, 3 pages. So it's taken them a little longer to photocopy it than expected. We were hoping to have it ready by 9 o'clock this morning, but it's not. It'll only be ready about 11 or 12. So tomorrow we'll give everyone these three pages. And I'll explain a little bit that we're going to ask a question about those anathas, not that you'll have to learn all 6, 4, and 5, all 15 of them, but some of them. But I'll explain about that tomorrow when we actually have the sheets. Now, as far as the anatha pseudo-guru is concerned, we read yesterday from that Harmonist article some very explicit information given about how Putana, or the pseudo-guru, manifests in the form of organized so-called religion. There are also more subtle areas, like we mentioned, that if a person teaches beyond their own realization, then they can be considered pseudo-guru. And if a person tries to instruct disciples or students beyond their capacity to understand in a sort of fruitful way, you know, trying to take them to a level that they're not really equipped to come to yet, then they can also be considered pseudo-gurus. In this regard, the Srila Prabhupada, and particularly Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, spoke very strongly against the Babaji's at Radhakund, who are basically practicing like that, the practice of Siddha Pranali. As we explained the other day, it means that at the time of first initiation, you are told what is supposedly being an important word, supposedly your eternal relationship with Krishna. And then your practice of sadhana bhakti revolves around meditating on that. So the general understanding given by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and by Prabhupada is that those gurus are not, so-called gurus, are not equipped to actually reveal a person's eternal relationship with the Lord. And the people who they're instructing, even if they were actually being told what is actually their eternal relationship with the Lord, which we would assume they're not really, just someone's imagination on the subject, but even if they were actually being told what is actually their eternal relationship, they wouldn't be equipped to absorb it and then, like, try and practice so as to enter into it. So those are some ideas on that subject. Then I thought, really, what is more relevant to us, though? I would assume, I don't know, I would assume that none of you are thinking at this point of trying to enter into your eternal relationship with Krishna. So perhaps the mind, how the mind acts as pseudo-guru, might be a little more relevant on a practical level to all of us. So I've got a few quotes here from Srila Prabhupada on the subject about the mind and how the mind misleads us and how we can deal with the mind. Of course, it's a big, big subject, but just briefly I thought we could mention some points. First of all, I'll give you a few references of some verses, a couple of verses in Srimad Bhagavatam and also Bhagavad Gita, in which the nature of the mind to be the pseudo-guru is stated very clearly. Has everyone marked themselves present? No? Pass it back. Let's pass it straight back, thanks. So in Srimad Bhagavatam, of course there's so many verses, but a couple which I came across which I thought were very pertinent. They're both in the 5th canto, in the 6th chapter, verses 2 and 5. 5th canto, chapter 6, verse 2 and verse 5. So I'll read the translations. Shukadev Goswami speaking. My dear king, you have spoken correctly about the mind. However, after capturing animals, a cunning hunter does not put faith in them, for they might run away. Similarly, those who are advanced in spiritual life do not put faith in the mind. Indeed, they always remain vigilant and watch the mind's action. The idea being that now we're trying to practice Krishna consciousness, and we may get a bit of a grip on our mind, and we may think, oh yes, now I'm controlling my mind. I've done it. I've come to that point. So then we give up our vigilance and our attentiveness to watching the mind. But just as anyone else not mark themselves present, Matajis? No? Everyone? Okay. Fine. So just like a hunter who captures an animal, he doesn't think, oh, well, now I've got the animal and the animal, so that's it. The animal's under my control, then turn his back and the animal just runs away. So the mind is sometimes compared to an animal. You get hold of it, but then you turn your back and it's gone. Mind is like that. There are different ways of correcting beings who are on different levels of receptiveness to your attempts to correct them. It's said that you can correct, or you could say convince, a Brahmin through knowledge, a Kshatriya through power, a Vaishya through wealth. You can control them or convince them to accept your point of view in those ways. But an animal, there's the well-known, well, in Latin I think it's argumentum ad baculum, something like that, the argument of the stick. You can't convince them, but if you beat them, then they get the idea. Not that we particularly want to get into beating animals, but it seems that it's a pretty effective way, really. So, the mind is something like that. So first thing is, now that we're getting control or trying to get control of the mind, we shouldn't let up at any point and think that now I've done it. Now I've got my mind in hand, so everything's fine. Now we always have to remain vigilant. Then just a couple of verses later, verse 5 in that chapter, Shukadeva Goswami says, the mind is the root cause of lust, anger, pride, greed, lamentation, illusion, and fear. Combined, these constitute bondage to fruitive activity. What learned man would put faith in the mind? Then two verses from Bhagavad Gita, well-known verses, chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. Perhaps some of you would be familiar with those already. Lord Krishna says, one must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. That's chapter 6, verse 5. And then verse 6. For him who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. But for one who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. So we all know, we all have a mind. And we've been living in the association of our mind for many lifetimes, we don't know how many, and we've developed a very close relationship, very intimate. And generally we think that my mind is very nice. I must look after it. If my mind gets sad, it's not feeling encouraged due to certain circumstances, then I have to perk it up somehow, do something for it. Brighten it up. If my mind gets angry, then I have to allow it to express itself in my activities. If my mind becomes attracted to some material attraction, then, oh, I have to make it my business to get that and enjoy it. So this has been our pattern of activity for so many lifetimes. And now we're trying to become Krishna conscious, but we find out that me and my mind are not the same, and the interests of my mind, or what my mind feels to be its interests, and what are actually my interests, they're really two different things. Krishna saying here, your mind can be your friend and your mind can be your enemy. But generally we should understand that on our levels in Krishna consciousness, that the mind will be more prone to be the enemy than the friend. So what to do? So we have some suggestions. First of all, of course, that the ultimate principle is to always think of Krishna, engage the mind. I'm sure you all know the story of the genie in the bottle. Anyone not know that story? Genie in the bottle? Really? Oh, I thought it was one of the... a story everyone knew. We're going to tell it very briefly. There was a genie in a bottle, and some people got it to come out, actually a king and his minister. And the genie told them, I'll do anything you want, I'm extremely capable. But the only thing is you have to keep me engaged all the time. If at any point you fail to engage me, I'll kill you immediately. So they thought, well, no problem. We've got plenty for this genie to do. So they told him something like, clean the palace, big palace. And they thought, well, this will probably take a few days or a week. But he was back in 5 minutes, saying, come on, engage me, otherwise I'll kill you. So then they thought, yes, well, what do we do? Clean the whole kingdom. So they thought, this will take months, years. He was back in 10 minutes. The kingdom was clean. And again he was insisting, engage me, otherwise I'll kill you right now. So then they thought, well, you go and speak to every one of the citizens in the country, find out what they want, and fulfill their desires. And they thought, he'll never finish that. But he was back in about 15 minutes. I did it. Engage me. So then they thought, well, what can we do now? So then the minister thought, there are two different versions at this point. One version is that there was a flagpole. They told him that you climb up to the top, and when you get to the top, climb down. And when you get to the bottom, climb up again. And just carry on, and we'll get back to you when there's a change of service required. So that's one. The idea being you have to engage the mind and just keep it engaged. In this way, in this regard, Prabhupada once was asked, it's in the Conversations books, that if there was a war, what would you have your disciples do? Prabhupada said, it'd be better for them to make guns and bombs for the war than do nothing. Because if you try and do nothing, your mind will destroy you. So keep engaged. One has to keep engaged. Then the other version, which is, anyway, it's a nice version. They tell the genie to chant Hare Krishna. And the genie becomes a devotee. And he just chants, which is the same idea really, engage the mind, and particularly in chanting Hare Krishna. So this then ultimately is the point. We have to engage the mind in bona fide activity, otherwise the mind will tend to be the pseudo guru and tell us that, well, you know, you should actually be doing this, and why are you doing this other activity? It's not really so good. And the mind has so many bright ideas. So we have to engage the mind in bona fide activity. But then, having said that, sometimes it's not so easy to do. Sometimes you may want to engage the mind. Okay, let's chant. But the mind says, no. I want to think about something. The latest gossip. Or whatever it may be, the latest controversy. Some sense gratification, how I need more sleep, how I'm not being treated properly. The mind will come up with some idea like that. Even though we're trying to engage the mind, it fights back. So, there are two main methods that I've come across suggested by Srila Prabhupada for dealing with an uncooperative mind, which won't engage. Engagement being like the main consideration, but sometimes the mind won't do that. So Prabhupada gave two main suggestions that I've come across. One is that you neglect the mind. The mind says, I don't want to chant. I want to think about something. So you just don't listen to it, and you just chant. And the mind will try and come up again with its idea, but you just ignore it. Something like a child. Children, sometimes they come along and they pester the mother or the father or someone. They want something. So sometimes, if you neglect the child, if you just ignore the child, sometimes the child will realize it's not going to get what it wants and just leave you alone. Another thing actually suggested by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is that if the mind won't cooperate, beat it. Beat it. Prabhupada said, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say that to control the mind, one should beat it with shoes 100 times just after awakening, and beat it with a broomstick before going to sleep. In this way, one can control the mind. Now, what do we mean by beat it? Does it mean you have to take a stick and start hitting yourself on the head, or some sort of self-abuse of some sort? No, but beating the mind means something like you can shout at your mind within your mind, chastise your mind, tell your mind, like in a very clear and straightforward way, that just to keep quiet, just cooperate. Be a little forceful with the mind. And then Prabhupada says, which is really connected with the ultimate point of engaging the mind in devotional service, Prabhupada says, another bona fide process for controlling the mind is to abide strictly by the orders of the spiritual master and engage in the Lord's service. Then the mind will be automatically controlled. If one does not do so, one is doomed to follow the dictations of the mind. So those are some ideas about the mind. Now we'll go on to Shakat Asura. Shakat Asura, page 15. Shakat Asura, that's the demon who was... There are three different versions as to what his actual nature or position was. One version is that he was a ghost. Another version is that he had a body made of air and was either as the ghost or with the body of air was sitting on the cart. Shakat actually means cart. And the other version is that he had assumed the form of a cart. So three versions. Anyway, this demon represents a load-carrying mentality. In other words, the tendency to carry too many material attachments and to really feel the need to like accumulate things for one's protection and security rather than take shelter of Krishna and be secure under his protection. Then he also represents lethargy, dullness, and false pride. And Krishna removes this contamination by kicking it aside. Shakat Asura was very fortunate. He received the touch of the lotus feet of the Lord. So did Putana. Krishna was so angry with Putana that when he was sucking on her breast, he was also punching her and kicking her. So with every limb and every part of his body, he was punishing her, but including kicking her with his lotus feet. And as we'll find mentioned in regard to Kaliya. It's pointed out with Kaliya that he got mercy that Lord Brahma never gets. We haven't heard of Lord Brahma getting the touch of Krishna's lotus feet, or even Lord Shiva. So they're really very fortunate. Now, according to Garga Samhita, which is a Vedic scripture, in his previous life, Shakarasura was one of the sons of Hiranyaksha. And what happened was that in the previous Manvantara, the lifetime of the previous Manu, we're in the life of Vaivasvata Manu now, but in the life of the Chakshusha Manu, long time ago, that's like about at least 120 million years ago or more, then this son of Hiranyaksha, whose name was Utkacha, who was a big, powerful giant, he, in order just to have fun, he would go and harass sages by going over to their ashrams and breaking up their ashrams and pulling out the trees which were in the area of the ashram. So one day he went to the ashram of Loma Shamuni, one great sage of the universe who's been around since the beginning of the universe, and he did the same thing. He started pulling up the trees and just throwing them around and sneering and making all sorts of clever comments to Loma Shamuni. So Loma Shamuni then cursed him that you have this big, powerful physical body, but you're abusing it by misusing it. You should be using it in the service of the Lord, but you're using it to abuse saintly persons. So therefore, he said, I curse you to lose your physical form, lose your gross body. And strictly according to this book, to become a ghost, actually. A little bit of ghost lore, L-O-R-E, for those of us who may be into ghosts. I don't know if any of you are, but ghosts are very susceptible to air, to the movement of air, apparently. So, Shakadasura, in this ghostly form, he was trying to get out of where the air was moving. Therefore, he went into the courtyard of Nanda Maharaja's house. And he was like in one corner where this cart was, trying to stay away from where the air was moving. So, right on the spot, Utkacha lost his body and suddenly found he was just floating around, just a subtle body. So then he realized what he'd done wrong, and then he begged forgiveness from Loma Shamuni. And Loma Shamuni said, all right, in the lifetime of the next Manu, Lord Krishna will appear and you'll be freed from this curse by being kicked by the lotus feet of the Lord. So, in this way, it happened that he ended up in that particular state. So, the pastime itself takes place when Krishna was about 3 months old, in other words, just shortly after Putana had come and been killed. Krishna at that time, he hadn't begun to crawl, but he was just coming to the point of trying to crawl. So he would try and raise himself up on his side. And when children do that, there's a Vedic ceremony called... Krishna appeared to be a little sleepy, so she put Krishna down on some sort of bed which was under this cart, big household cart. And then she lay down with Krishna to just help him to fall asleep. Then she got up and went to greet all the guests. But then Krishna woke up and he felt hungry, so he cried. Of course, he couldn't go over and attract and catch hold of Mother Yashoda because he couldn't even crawl. So he was in a helpless condition. crying out there. They got so angry that he started kicking his legs and kicked the cart, and this big household cart just exploded, and the wheels went flying off, everything just went flying, and there was a tremendous crash. Actually, it was loaded up with all sorts of metal pots and metal utensils, so they went clanging and crashing around on the ground. So there was really quite a commotion. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes a very interesting comment that through Krishna doing like this, kicking the cart, smashing it to pieces, and at the same time killing the demon who was associated with the cart in one way or another, Krishna illustrated the fact that he is actually Swayam Bhagavan. Interesting point. Even though Krishna's legs are described, his hands and legs resembled soft new leaves, very delicate, very, very delicate, very fine. But still, just as a little infant, he smashed this big cart and killed this big demon. He was really a very big demon, and Krishna killed him. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that in order to kill Hiranyakashipu, the Lord had to assume the Nrisinga form, half man, half lion. In order to defeat Bali Maharaj, the Lord had to assume the gigantic form of Vamana, so he could in one step practically cover the whole universe. But as Krishna, just as a little baby, with his legs, he killed this demon and smashed the cart. Therefore, Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, chief of all forms. So when everyone noticed what had happened, all this great commotion was going on, they all came running over and saw that this cart just in pieces all over the place. And there was a little baby Krishna lying there. And they just couldn't understand what on earth had happened. But some of the other little children who were there, they said, oh, we saw. Krishna did it. He just kicked the cart and it went flying. But no one would accept it. They all assumed that it was the influence of a bad planet, somehow or other. So then they did some, along with having the ceremony, they also did some performance to offset the influence of bad planets. And the final thing which Mother Yashoda did, which was the final sign that everything was okay, and Krishna was really safe now. Anyone know what was the final thing which Mother Yashoda did, Mother Manjari? Yes, she breastfed Krishna. And Krishna very happily sucked her breast. And that was the final sign that Krishna is now, you know, pacified after this rather dramatic incident. So now, regarding the anatha of carrying loads, of course every one, practically every aspiring devotee, we all have the tendency to take shelter of the material nature, even though we understand in principle that Krishna is there, the philosophy is there, so many statements are there that Krishna protects his devotees and provides what they lack and preserves what they have. But still, sometimes devotees have the tendency to feel that they need to make like extraneous arrangements, and in some cases some devotees may even get quite carried away in providing for themselves materially through not really having so much faith that Krishna will protect us. So there's a very interesting lecture that Prabhupada gave He's speaking on Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, verse 22. Ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana parupasate. Some of you may have heard the lecture. It's quite well known. In that verse, Krishna's saying that for my devotee, for my pure devotee, or at least for my devotee who's always thinking of me, ananyas chintayanto mam, for one who's always thinking of me, then I preserve what they have and I carry to them what they lack. So in one lecture on that verse, Prabhupada tells a very amazing story. It's the story of Arjuna Acharya. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard the story, but I'll read this excerpt from Prabhupada's lecture. Listen carefully, it's very, very nice, very wonderful what Prabhupada says. So Prabhupada says, now, the materialist says, all right, you devotees, you do not know whether you're going back to Godhead or not. You're giving up this material enjoyment. You're simply living on chapatis. Oh, we've got so many palatable dishes and you're not enjoying this. You're a fool. In other words, the devotees are trying to live simply. But of course, the karmis, they're really, their whole business is to increase their material facilities. So they think devotees are fools. So to these poor devotees who are taking chapatis, the Lord says a very nice thing. What is that? Ananyas chintayanto mam, ye jana parupasate, tesham nityabhyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. Well, materialist, Mr. Materialist, you have to work very hard. But hear the assurances from the Lord that those who are unflinching and 100% devoted in the transcendental service of me, for them I take charge of their maintenance, all comforts. Now, this sloka is very important for the devotees. There was a great devotee. His name was Arjunacharya. So when he was writing commentaries on this particular verse, he saw tesham nityabhyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. The Lord says, I myself take the burden and I take the load on my head and I deliver it to my devotees, what they require, what they require. The devotee doesn't require to go outside. I myself go and deliver the goods, whatever he requires. This is written here. Tesham nityabhyuktanam. Yoga means what is required by him. And shemam means what he has got, he requires to be protected. So these two things, the Lord takes charge, that I personally do it. For whom? Ananyas chintayanto mam. Those who have no other thought than Krishna. Now, this Arjunacharya, that's a very nice story. When he was writing commentaries, oh, he thought, how is it that Lord will come himself and deliver the goods? Oh, it's not possible. He might be sending through some agent. So he wanted to cut out Vahami Aham, which literally means I carry. I bear the burden and deliver. And he wrote in a way that I send some agent who delivers. So that Arjunacharya went to take bath, and in the meantime, two boys, very beautiful boys, they brought some very nice foodstuff in large quantity. So these two boys brought some very highly valuable foodstuff and grains and ghee. And his wife was there, and the boys said, my dear mother, Arjunacharya has sent these goods to you. Please take delivery. She was very surprised and she said, oh, you're so nice boys. You're so beautiful boys. And he's given so much burden to you. And one boy, who was a darker skinned boy, said, oh, I didn't want to take. And just see, he beat me. Here is cane mark. Oh, see, his wife became very much astonished that Acharya is not so cruel. How has he become so cruel? So she was thinking of that way. Then, all right, my dear boys, you come in. And the boy said, no, We'll go, because Arjuna Acharya is again coming. He'll chastise us. She said, no, no, just sit down, take some foodstuffs. Then they went away. Then the Acharya returned, because this one darker-skinned boy showed he had cuts on his back from the cane. Then the Acharya returned, and his wife said, Acharya, you have become so much cruel nowadays. He said, oh, what is that? She said, two boys, very nice boys. They've brought so much foodstuff. You loaded it on their heads, and they couldn't take it. And you beat them, chastised them. He said, no, I've never done this. Why shall I do it? Then she described, oh, such beautiful, nice boys. Then Arjuna Acharya understood that because I thought that God does not deliver, so to show me, he's delivered these goods. And because I cut these alphabets that he does not give personally, so he has shown that beating mark. Here the Lord says that I personally deliver. So those who are in Krishna consciousness, those who are actually busy in the matter of discharging their duties as a Krishna conscious person, they may be assured that so far their living condition is concerned, or their comforts of life is concerned, that is assured by the Lord. There'll be no hampering. So those two boys, I'm sure you caught it, they were Krishna and Balaram. And because he, as Prabhupada says, he cut the alphabets. He actually physically cut the words out and then wrote something else in that place. So that was because Bhagavad Gita is the body of the Lord. He had effectively cut the body of the Lord and caused him pain. So, but then he realized, and there are other versions of the story, that when he realized that my wife is such a great devotee, that Krishna and Balaram personally came and delivered by hand, and I'm such a demon that I cut Krishna. Then he thought, oh, my wife is such a great devotee. So he went and threw himself at her feet. I don't know if many husbands do that. But he did that. He threw himself at her feet. You're such a great devotee. Then he went running around. Some say it was Jagannath Puri. He went running around Jagannath Puri, calling out, Vahami, Vahami. which means, I carry, I carry. And everyone was wondering, what happened to the Acharya? So, we should try and have faith that Krishna will provide, and at least that we don't have to make some, you know, like big extravagant arrangements and get sidetracked. Because sometimes, I'm sure we're all aware, we've seen in some cases, some devotees sometimes get sidetracked from Krishna consciousness by getting too much into this whole idea that I have to, in effect, build up my load of material attachments. Now, let's see. Regarding lethargy, because Chakrasura represents load carrying, lethargy, dullness. So regarding lethargy, there's one verse in Bhagavad Gita in which Lord Krishna particularly urges Arjuna that he says, this is chapter 3, verse 30. Therefore, O Arjuna, this is like a formula, you could say, for avoiding lethargy. Surrendering all your works unto me, with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, this verse clearly indicates the purpose of Bhagavad Gita. The Lord instructs that one has to become fully Krishna conscious to discharge duties as if in military discipline. Sometimes this may make things a little difficult, but nevertheless, duties must be carried out. So, of course, Prabhupada didn't often use this concept of military discipline. I'm not going to try to overstress the idea of acting in Krishna consciousness as if in military discipline. But still, we should be careful not to let laziness overcome us. Then I'll read one other quote from Srila Prabhupada, in which he's also talking about the need to basically stand up. In the Bhagavatam it says, the cure for sleepiness is standing up. So, like encouraging the idea of standing up against the tendency to be lazy and complacent. Prabhupada says, similarly, sometimes there's extreme cold, but everyone's taking bath in the Ganges. Nobody says, oh, I'll not take bath. So duty has to be done. There may be some suffering, temporary. But Krishna never says, oh my dear Arjuna, you're my friend. All right, you're feeling so much sorry. All right, I shall do it for you. You sit down silent. In the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I think it's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, when Arjuna says, oh Govinda, I shall not fight. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that in effect, Arjuna is telling Krishna that if you want this battle fought, then you fight it. And as for me, I'm going to sit down here in my chariot and sulk. But Krishna's not encouraging that idea. No. Krishna never says that. He says that you have to do it. Although he says that this battle is arranged by me. They're already killed. No one is going back alive. But still, you have to do it. So our duty, persons who are in Krishna consciousness, they should always know that everything is to be done by Krishna. We cannot do anything without Krishna's sanction. But still, we have to do our own duty. Not that, oh, Krishna will do everything. Therefore we shall not try for a storefront, or we shall not go to see this man, or just leave it to Krishna. No, that is lethargy. You have to do your own duty. But result, depend on Krishna. This is Krishna conscious. You don't be sorry if there's failure. You don't be too much, jubilant, if there's success. Everything's done by Krishna. This is the attitude of Krishna consciousness. But they have to do their own duty. Never mind whether it is suffering or happiness. It doesn't matter. So somehow we have to try and cultivate this attitude of being a little sort of resolute. As Krishna says there in the second chapter, that those who are successful in Krishna consciousness, Vyavasayatmaka Buddhya, Ekeha Kurunandana, Bahushaka Hyanantascha Buddhayo Vyavasayanam. Those who are actually successful, they have this resoluteness of purpose. It's also connected, of course, with the idea of controlling the mind. We have to be a little strong. Prabhupada has suggested, even possibly up to the point of being like military discipline. Anyway, at least we have to be strong and not become the humble servants of our mind and our senses. Any comments or questions? Yes, bro.
I'm a bit confused because you said this demon, he enters the garden of Maharaj by accident, taking shelter, finding a place to take shelter from the wind. So he didn't go into Vrindavan, that I assume purposely to kill Krishna. So then why, when he enters the golden stone, did he decide to kill Krishna? It wasn't sent by Kamsa also.
Now, Shakadasura is sent by Kamsa, but as I said, as a bit of ghost law meaning just information about ghosts, ghosts don't like being to be where the air is moving. So he chose as a place to go, Actually, what he wanted to do, his idea was to kill Krishna by making the cart collapse on top of Krishna and crush little baby Krishna. That was his idea, in fact. But he chose a place which was out of where the air was moving, because ghosts, apparently, they can just be blown by the movement of air. Mahamantra Prabhu. Some words of wisdom, yes.
On the tape, it appeared that Srila Prabhupada is referring to that if you want to be lazy about it, lethargy, that Krishna, you're asking me to fight, so you're my friend, so you do it. Right. And I'll sit and smoke ganja. Meaning, with reference to their bad habits, previous bad habits, because he was lecturing to a lot of previous hippies in the West.
That was the early days, I think.
Right, and so their habits was that if you, when there's leisure, then they will sit and they will smoke intoxication. So if you want to be less enthusiastic for serving Krishna, you will automatically fall back into your old habits.
Right.
Like smoking intoxication.
Yeah, that's a good point. The idle mind is the devil's workshop. And if one fails to engage fully in devotional service, if one becomes complacent and apathetic, then one will slip back, punamushtika bhava, slip back into the same position one was in before one became Krishna conscious. Just another little interesting thing Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, in the same purport, the purport to that same verse, chapter 9, verse 22, his purport, he says that Arjuna says to Krishna that you have to do so many things for your devotee. Preserve what they have, carry things to them if they lack. Doesn't that show that the devotee is lacking in feeling for you? Because he's engaging you in his service. The devotee is so fully engaged in your service, he doesn't have time to look after himself, so you have to look after him. So Arjuna suggests, wouldn't it be more indicative of love on the part of the devotee if the devotee just took some time off from serving you in order to provide his own things or preserve his own things rather than force you to do it? Wouldn't that be more indicative of love? And Krishna says, no, it's not like that. I do these things, I carry things and preserve things for my devotee, because I want to. I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it. He says, just like a father with his family, he doesn't really feel it a burden, but he enjoys looking after his family and providing for them. He finds it very nice. It's one of his main impetuses in life, if not his main impetus. So these are my people, the devotees. They're my family. I want to do things for them. For the devotee who's fully engaged. Some other comments or questions, Madhaji?
What can we do when some bad habits are so strong that you cannot get away?
Yes. Yes, well, old habits die hard. At the best of times, particularly some really bad habits or really strong bad habits. So the thing is, of course, we shouldn't just willingly give in to these things. We should try and fight against them, stand up against them. But it is a fact, and we see sometimes some devotees, they're trying, but they just can't do it. And then they, you know, some fall is there. Not that they're really being devious, but it's more, it's as much just weakness as anything else. So Prabhupada, in discussing that, he said, one devotee asked him that, what happens if a devotee falls down? Prabhupada said he should just get up and try again. And the devotee asked, well, what if he falls down again? Prabhupada said he should just get up and try again. And then Prabhupada said, he may fall down again. He should just get up again. So every time he should just try and carry on. And Prabhupada said, eventually, whatever that like big thing is, it's a major sort of anatha there, whatever that big thing is, every time he gets up and tries again, a little bit more of it will be cleansed away until it'll come to the point that it'll be gone. And then he'll be able to become more firmly situated. You know, we've all experienced that in the very early days, you know, we're very susceptible to the influence of Maya. But generally, at least, the idea is that as you persevere, you gradually become more and more fixed. So, you know, in many cases, it doesn't mean that you'll actually fall down, although there'll be some struggle. But the reason that you eventually or gradually become a little more fixed, it's the same thing, that those big anathas are just getting cleaned away gradually. And as they're becoming more and more cleaned away, then it's easier for you to be fixed. In fact, I know one devotee, he's a very nice devotee. He joined around the same time I did. And back in those days, meaning the early or mid-70s, he had some very big anatha. So almost like clockwork, every 2 to 3 weeks, he'd leave. He'd bloop. He'd be gone. And about two or three days later, he'd be back, completely fried. And he'd try again. And again, after just 2 or 3 weeks, he'd be gone again. It was amazing. You know, it must have happened at least 50 times. At least. It just went on for some years. But, you know, still he had it within him, within his mind, that actually Krishna consciousness is really the best thing and I should just try. So then gradually, whatever it was, he got over it. And now he's a very good devotee. Very, very good devotee indeed. So, when we're faced with some major problem, we should be extra careful in our chanting. Try and chant without, like, make a special effort. We should pray for mercy. Yeah, I mean, the general idea would be make a real special effort to get some shelter from that onslaught of the material energy. Try to take shelter of the devotees. Try to take shelter of the spiritual master. Pray to the deities. Try and perhaps to get some more direct personal service to the deities or the spiritual master, like this. And in this way one can get some extra strength to get over some big hurdle. But whatever happens, one should carry on. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Api Chet Siddharacharo Bhajate Mama Nanyabhak, even if a devotee does something terrible, really abominable, but as long as he or she remains engaged in devotional service, should be considered saintly and will quickly become righteous and attain lasting peace. So the like essential point is that the devotee remains engaged and doesn't just give up and go away. Any other point, Sankarshan Prabhu?
Right. Verse. I just don't understand what you're trying to convey about this pastime by illustrating that story.
Yeah. Well, the whole idea is about loads. Yeah. So the Lord is saying in that verse that I carry the load, Vahami. So Krishna and Balaram came and they carried the load. They personally brought, like, material needs, the material necessities of Arjunacharya. But Arjunacharya, he didn't have faith in that. Therefore, he cut out the words.